Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. I got my first guest of the Friday, and we're talking about a subject dear to lots of people's hearts. A subject, I think, that has been sadly overlooked through the mists of time. The book is called The Meaning of Beer. Quote, how our pursuit of the perfect pint built the world. Looking at the world through a glass half empty, a glass half full, but a glass of beer. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line is international prize winning author and writer, beer journalist, I believe, Johnny Garrett. Johnny, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for that intro. That'll finally convince my parents I've got a real career.
How do you become a beer journalist? I mean, a lot of journalists, because I used to be one. I mean, our lives sort of centered around the pub back in the day. So, presumably this is the explosion of craft beers, and now it's a thing, beer journalism?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there were writers before sort of the craft beer explosion, some great people like Michael Jackson, not that one, Pete Brown, Melissa Cole, Roger Protz. But yeah, definitely the explosion of sort of micro brewing all over the world has helped. And I was actually working for Jamie Oliver at the time. I was working on his website and he started a food tube channel on YouTube. And I borrowed all his equipment and started making videos reviewing beers. And somehow... 13 years later, it's turned into a full-time writing and broadcasting job.
Nice work if you can get. So what is, just quickly before we talk about them, what does the average day of a beer journalist consist of, apart from sort of getting up very late and grabbing the Alka-Seltzer and going, never again?
Yeah, well, you know, I have to get up quite early because brewers are absolute animals and like to get up and mash in at like 6, 7 a.m. So I spend a lot of the time getting up very early and regretting what I've consumed the night before. But... generally, you know, I get sent huge amounts of beer. I do lots of tastings. I do online tastings throughout the evenings and things like this for my YouTube channel. And otherwise, I'm, you know, much like a journalist, writing, making calls, and doing, you know, a fair amount of travel like I've done for the book. You know, I've been all over the world for that. I think five different continents to bring it all in. So it's, you know, because it's such a universal product, it takes you everywhere.
So what was the spark then that made you think, hang on, we haven't really looked into how beer has affected history and how it's had a central part in a lot of political and social events?
Well, there were sort of two sparks, really, two flints. One is... a bit like I alluded to earlier, and my parents maybe not believing it's a real career. It's lots of people sort of saying, is that really a job? Or particularly saying something like, it's just beer. How can you sort of write about that for a career? Is there really enough stuff to say? And so this book is sort of a 90,000 word response to that belief. But the main reason is when I was writing my third book, A Year in Beer, I came across this fact that the fridge was invented not for food, but for beer. It was originally invented to cool the cellars of a brewery called Spaten in Munich. And that just made me think, well, what other examples are there of technologies or, you know, cultural revolutions or philosophies that were created either over a pint or because of a pint? And, you know, again, turns out about 90,000 words worth.
But the thing is, you would think that, you know, the earliest drinks would be, you know, we always tend to think of, you know, Egyptians, Romans, Greeks. Wine is always sort of front and center. Northern Europe, you'd think mead would be, or, you know, but beer is apparently one of the oldest drinks.
Yeah, I think certainly it would be able to make a claim for the oldest alcoholic beverage. Certainly the oldest purposefully made alcoholic beverage. So the idea of wine is sort of about 6,000 years younger than beer. Beer, we think, is about 13,000 years old, probably older, because the earliest instance we have of it being made, the technology is so advanced, it can't be the first time that it was done. But yeah, I mean, humans up until that point, if they were getting remotely inebriated, it was off of usually rotten fruits and things like that. But clearly at some point, some discovery was made that if you left grain, it would start to go alcoholic. It would start to make you feel, you know, rather good and a little bit more confident around the campfire. And that was probably a result of spent grain from bread going off. So we think bread is probably a tiny bit older than beer, and beer was kind of the result of that.
And if you're thinking sort of people who have big stocks of grain, we're talking, Egypt, that's that sort of area. I mean, it's difficult to think of, you know, the Egyptians with a pint in their hand, but presumably that was one of the first places it came to be recognised.
Yeah, I mean, so the earliest record we have is Israel, a place called the Rakfet Cave near-ish Nazareth. So it's in that sort of the cradle of civilization, as we call it. So the Sumerians, the Egyptians, you know, relied on beer as a daily need. It was safe water, because water wasn't always safe back then. It was great nutrition. It was storable, which wasn't always true of your foods. So it was, you know, it was so important to daily life in our early civilizations that it was currency, essentially. So the people that built the pyramids were paid in beer and cloth and bread. That was their wages. But it, you know, it predates the ancient Egyptians by, you know, nearly 10,000 years.
Would it be beer as we know it, as the saying goes? You know, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Would this be beer as we know it, or is it sort of some sort of primitive? I mean, obviously they're not having it in pints; they're presumably having it in bowl. I mean, but do we know how the Egyptians sort of enjoyed their beer?
Yeah, we've got, so particularly the Sumerians were really, really good record keepers. And some of the earliest references we have to recipes and things like this are the Sumerians, because they, you know, they had a language in cuneiform, and were rigorous accountants as well. The first ever maths mistake we know of was actually on a receipt for beer, in Sumeria. But so they were probably drinking something that was more like alcoholic porridge. So they would have learned to filter it eventually, but a lot of the stuff we have from the ancient Sumerians is them drinking with straws. So they'd have been sort of filtering at the very last moment, sucking up the liquid from a grainy kind of porridge that would have been only 1 or 2%. So it would have been hard to get a little bit drunk on that. The beer as we know it is a pretty modern invention. There's references particularly to monasteries in France and in Belgium in between like 800 and 1100, where we start to talk about hops, malt, water and well, yeast, we didn't know what it did until the 1800s, but we knew it was important to add to it. We just didn't know what it was doing as early as that, really.
Is there a sort of quasi-religious thing? Because obviously wine, it's sacrament, it's, you know, altars, all that sort of thing. That is, we do that, associate that with wine, with religious ceremonies. Did you find sort of beer having a part in any sort of ceremony down the ages?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, wine's sort of come in and taken that role, I think, certainly through Christianity, and, you know, the miracles of Jesus and this kind of thing. But up until that point, and indeed long afterwards, beer was inseparable from religion. So at Rakafet Cave, this place in Israel, the earliest reference we have to beer, that was also a burial site for the Natufians that lived there, and we're fairly certain that they were brewing it in proximity because they were, you know, giving it to their ancestors after it was brewed. We know that the Egyptians did the same. In fact, there's a brewery that's the size of Fuller's batch size has been found in the desert in Abydos, which was sort of the original Valley of the Kings, where all the early kings of Egypt, like Narmer, were buried. And then that stretches right through the Sumerians. The word for their religious feasts translates as beer, which I absolutely love. And then we know that the monasteries were the big commercial brewers of Europe for thousands of years, and that only they only divorced, you know, beer and monasteries during the Reformation and the dissolution. And we still have, there's still 11 monasteries around the world called Trappist breweries that brew all the beer within the walls of the monastery and use it to fund their way of life. So it's still just about there, but only the remnants.
I'm just imagining the people saying, oh yes, we found this ancient chalice. It must have been something, and it's a beer. It's a Toby jug, basically, from the Sumerians.
Exactly that, yeah. I mean, in Egypt, so at this site where they had this brewery, the brewery was one of the last things they discovered. They only really realized the significance of it, that it was a brewery, in 2018. But we'd known about the site of Abydos for over 100 years. So they had to sort of change their archaeological kind of theories around it, because suddenly they were like, well, there's a massive brewery here. And they couldn't actually find any cups, like evidence of people drinking it. So again, we think that it was all poured out immediately as a sacrifice to the gods and to the kings that had died. So there's all these kind of bizarre references to the way that, you know, beer was important in life back then that we just can't really comprehend, just pouring beer on the floor.
I just like the idea that archaeologists go in thinking they're going to find a temple or a palace or something very, very, and then they find a massive, it's like, we're not looking for this, so we don't know what it is, sort of thing.
Well, yeah, so the brewery was discovered in the early 20th century, and they didn't really understand what it was or sort of couldn't conceive what it was. So they just buried it again. And then somebody, you know, 70 years later was like, I think we should have a look at that again. Let's find out what that was.
Why, you mentioned Munich and you mentioned sort of Central Europe. Why is that, if you think sort of proper beers, why is that area of Europe particularly renowned for its beer drinking, its beer culture?
You know, you could write a book on that, and actually, that's kind of slightly my plan for book 5. But it's a really, oh yeah, so you've, the cat's out of the bag.
Yep.
You've it's a really complicated story. But what we have to remember is that at the moment, lager is, you know, the king of beers. It is the thing that most people consume. It's about 70% of the beer that's consumed around the world. And the concept of that came about from Munich, Central Europe, Pilsen, the Czech Republic. And so, you know, although that's kind of a blip in the history of beer, it's only, what, maybe 500 years of 13,000 years of brewing. It's been hugely significant. And that comes from the fact that the local yeasts that were in that area were lager yeasts. So a lager yeast, difference between a lager and an ale, is just the yeast that's used and the temperature it ferments at. And the local yeasts that were in the air in that part of the world were lager yeasts. So, you know, it's partly sort of the modern trend for beer went towards lager, and this was the place that it was born. But it's also because of, you know, its part that it played in the Holy Roman Empire, because of some of the dukes and the kings that ruled Bavaria and Bohemia back then. You know, they brewed huge amounts of beer, they owned breweries, they made laws around it, like the Reinheitsgebot, that told you what you could and couldn't put into beer. And really, beer, because it was a daily inevitability and it was controlled by the kings, became, you know, significantly more important. And that sort of held on for a long time, unlike in other nations where local brewing scenes started to disappear.
How did they export this beer? Because you just, I'm currently on a Holy Roman Empire kick at the moment, historically, and the Byzantines. So was this beer for local consumption, or were they able to, if you like, so, I mean, presumably keeping it, did he need to keep it cold? I mean, did it travel well, or was it purely for people around the area?
It would have depended on the brewery. There would have been lots of local breweries that were making purely for their local market. But increasingly, particularly as the reputation of Bavarian and Bohemian beer spread, then people started to want to drink it. There's a great story, the founding of Carlsberg, which, you know, I don't necessarily like the beer these days that much, but it is one of the most important breweries to have ever existed and had, you know, has made some huge technological discoveries. That was only founded because the founder, J.C. Jacobsen, tried a Bavarian lager from his local wine merchant in Copenhagen. So we know that these beers were getting out of their original places, and that sort of helped the reputation. We know that Budvar, which has a whole chapter in the book, was mostly famous for being an export brewery, and that was a source of huge pride to a nation in the Czech Republic, which wasn't really a nation. Its borders were constantly moving. It didn't necessarily rule itself for huge chunks of its history. So having, you know, this ability to say this is our beer, this is a Czech beer, and it's drunk all over the world, was a source of huge pride to them, and almost a form of national identity when that was hard to find.
What about the cultural aspects? Because you think about, you know, beer in Bavaria, and you're thinking about, you know, Lederhosen and, you know, massive steins and people clinking and singing. Does the beer sort of latch onto a festival that's already going, or does the festival come and they just throw cultural aspects at it, and so it's now intertwined? Because Oktoberfest, you know, everybody thinks, okay, it, you know, it's a drinking party, but presumably there are some poetry readings somewhere.
I don't know, maybe at certain very geeky tables there's something else going on. It is, having been four times, it is a full-on assault on the senses of pretzels and beer and umpire music. But it's kind of almost impossible, particularly in the big brewing nations, to separate beer and culture. They are just completely intertwined. The origins of Oktoberfest, it was 1810. It was the wedding of Princess Therese and King Ludwig the Second, or the First, one of the two. And that just spawned a great party. They hosted a party for the sort of the common folk, and that turned into Oktoberfest. So it was something that has developed over time. Initially, it was a horse race with some, you know, some beer thrown in, and it sort of evolved with the times. And so beer, whenever there's a big celebration, whenever there's, you know, a death, a wedding, a baptism, whatever it is, beer was always involved. And some of these traditions have evolved into huge things, and you see that all over the world. In fact, you see Oktoberfests all over the world because there's a huge diaspora of Germans in the mid 19th century, and that's why lager spread so far around the world as well, because it was the Czechs, the Austrians, and the Germans,
and also
going,
of course,
there and brewing.
It's been marketed as well, hasn't it? I mean, Oktoberfest, I mean, I remember when I was living in London, it was in Battersea. You know, it just goes all over the place. And perhaps it's not, you know, the beer isn't important, it's the huge amounts of drinking that take place. And that brings me to my next question. Is there, you know, because we have things like, you know, Pamplona, you know, bull running, and the tomato festival, where people throw, you know, old tomatoes at each other. And it seems to be part of the stopping off on the people who are doing Europe. And they've had to sort of put sort of you know, breaks and bans on it. So that sort of thing has happened. Has Oktoberfest changed during the time that you've been going, Johnny?
I mean, it's a great question. It's definitely grown. Mm. You know, Oktoberfest, you know, obviously struggled during COVID, but it's something like 7 million people visit Munich in those sort of 3 weeks that it's on. And that's just, you know, probably a nightmare for the locals, but it definitely has had to grow to sort of accommodate that. And I think it definitely has changed as well. And there's a story which I write about briefly in the book about, so after the First World War, it didn't have the money to start up again. And so the big six breweries, as they're now known, of Munich, came in and sort of funded it and kept it going again, but as a result got a monopoly on the beer. So I think before the First World War, you know, loads of breweries were pouring. There would have been loads of different tents. There would have been probably a little bit more diverse kind of... well, diverse maybe is too strong a word, but more variation in the beers being served and the people going. And that's sort of been whittled down by the influence of these big six breweries. But I'd imagine it's been roughly similar for the last couple of decades. And it's interesting when it does go abroad, either it's a complete failure. You know, whenever people try to host an Oktoberfest in the UK, we just have a different drinking culture. We can't drink 4 litres and be okay. You know, certainly of 6% lager, but you know, there's Oktoberfests in China, which I've been to. It's got more pole dancing than the original Oktoberfest, but
hang on. Just what Oktoberfest in China.
Exactly, yes. Asian Oktoberfest, it's colloquially known as. It's in Qingdao, and it's Qingdao that you drink, sort of that bottle that you probably get in lots of Chinese restaurants in the UK. Yeah, and it was founded as a result of Qingdao Brewery, which was founded in 1908 by German expats. There's a Brazilian Oktoberfest. That's the second biggest Oktoberfest in the world. Again, it's in a town that was founded by Germans. So what's really interesting about those ones is they sort of absorb a bit of the local culture, whereas we haven't quite found that in the UK. I think because you've got our own great beer festivals, you know, Green Hop festivals and Carscale festivals that have their own kind of character, and Oktoberfest is a slightly different concept to us.
Let's get the £800 sort of beer drinking gorilla out of the way, because you know, we're talking Munich, we're talking beer halls. It's been beer halls traditionally in Germany and all around the world have been places for meetings, and obviously we're talking how beer shaped the world. Well, you know, it's the 1920s, it's the 1930s, you're in Germany. How did you handle that one, Johnny, when you comes to writing sort of the rise of the far right and the Nazis?
Yeah, I mean, I think I say in the book, I say there's a lot more Hitler in this book than I originally envisaged. So there is a chapter on so the book is split out into things like technology, politics, culture, cuisine. And the politics chapter puts a lot of time aside for the fact that the far right movement in the 1920s that came out of, you know, the First World War surrender, the Treaty of Versailles, you know, friction with communist powers that were trying to get into Bavaria. A lot of that was played out in the beer halls. And in particular, it was played out in Hofbräuhaus, which is, you know, one of the most famous beer halls on earth. It was originally owned by the Wittelsbachs, who ran Bavaria for 900 years. And, you know, the Nazi Party was formed there. Hitler had his first ever meeting with the Workers' Party, which the Nazis came out of, in a different one, the Bürgerbräukeller. But Hofbräuhaus is just about, you know, people always say, you know, keep politics out of beer, but it's just impossible because Hitler, he was teetotaler. Mm. But he understood, therefore, as, you know, the sober person in the room, just how malleable, young, angry, poor working class men could be. And he totally used the effect of alcohol and the effects of, you know, crowds of people to whip them up into frenzies and to commit things they probably wouldn't have in other places. And to start to sort of instill beliefs that they might not have had if it weren't for the places that they learned them and the people that they met through doing it. And, you know, there's no denying that a lot of darkness has come out of the Munich beer halls. And we, you know, it's that darker side of alcohol, which the book doesn't sort of shy away from.
Mm, because I'm just thinking about, but also, you know, pubs are places where people, I mean, get away from that, because we could be here all week talking about Nazis and beer, trust me on this one. But, you know, we've always had discussions in pubs. Pubs have always been, there have been, you know, there have been political groups founded in the rooms above pubs. I mean, for meeting rooms, that's it is the pub or the hall, which is the centre of the community, and therefore, you know, beer is going to be involved in quite a few sort of momentous political occasions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you know, like, I'm sure that Guy Fawkes, when they were plotting that, were probably sat in a pub doing it, because that's where you'd have met. You'd have been able to be sort of incognito. These are sort of public / private spaces where you can meet people. But it you know, it's not just politics that pubs have played a role in. I tell the story of how, you know, the role of DNA was announced in a pub in Cambridge by, I think, a slightly inebriated Mr. Crick, who just stood up and went, "We've discovered the secret of life," which I'd imagine is a common occurrence. I've probably done it at some point while under the influence, but it certainly wasn't telling people the role of DNA. You know, the rules of cricket were written in the pub. There's just so many examples where, you know, alcohol has been a positive, I guess, influence, or has given people the stomach to really stand up for themselves and do something special.
And you talked about going to the five continents on this epic beer fuels journey. You went to the northernmost pub in the world? Tell me a little bit about that one.
Yeah, the northernmost pub and the northernmost brewery. So that is a place called Svalbard, which is an archipelago north of Norway. It is the most remarkable, beautiful, but stark kind of place that I've ever been. If you stand on the northern shores of the main town, Longyearbyen, you are in the top 100 most northerly people in the world. And then if you turn around and look at the town, there's a brewery right there on the coast.
Yeah.
And they make, you know, really great sort of modern American hoppy beers and great German lagers. The brewmaster is a German, but it's owned by somebody who used to work in the mines on Svalbard. It used to be basically a mining town, a company town. And back when he was working in the mines, beer was everything to them. They'd spend, you know, 10 to 12 hours in the dark. They'd come out, and because you're in the Arctic Circle half the year, it was dark again.
Yeah.
And so they had one like communal restaurant and bar where they'd go every single night. That was the only place you could eat out. And they'd just drink and drink and drink. And it was recognized by people that ran these mining towns that without that, it was very hard to build a sense of community. So they recognized that you had to have beer for these men to drink. You had to have a communal space for them to be. And so that was sort of the first and most important civic building. So I wanted to explore that, you know. Even in the world's most remote place, you need somewhere for that. And that miner, it was so important to him that eventually he went on to found a brewery, because he wanted the beer of this mining town to be, you know, produced by the people in the town and be local.
You see, there they go. Beer as a method of combating mining stress and anxiety, and it's cheaper than therapy.
Beer cheaper than therapy is probably not going to catch on as a tagline for any alcohol brands, but we can say it.
The thing is, like, okay, I'm in southern Spain. Hey, let's not even get started on the Spanish beers. But you know, in a world where we are being told that this is bad for us, and you know that this is bad for us, that is bad for us. You know, the pleasure of a simple pint. Are we? You know, do you feel confident that, you know, craft beer and beer in general will keep going, and they will still be drinking beer in, you know, 500,000 years or some derivative of it?
Yeah, there's never been a more interesting time, I think, to be a beer writer, and I guess to some extent to be a beer drinker, because, you know, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd have said there's never been a better time to be a beer drinker. The diversity of the beer that's being produced, the excitement, the innovations is incredible. But obviously we've got to the point where we understand the effect of alcohol on our bodies, and we understand the impact that it could have longer term, both society-wise and on ourselves. And so we're having a very interesting discussion in which beer has never been better. It's never been more of an artisan endeavor, really, certainly within the microbrewing sphere. But equally, we have this sort of public health pressure that's saying, but should we really even be consuming this? And my response to this has been, like, I mean, this book, to some extent, is, if not a response to that, is it should be part of the argument. Because if you look at what the world would look like without beer, it would be a much poorer place. We wouldn't have the fridge. We wouldn't have the idea of antiseptics. We wouldn't have half of the GM yeasts and things that produce anti-malarials that are used for studying cancer. All these kinds of things come from our relationship with beer, and particularly our relationship with yeast. It's hugely important to the development of humanity. And then we have to talk about how pubs are saviors for people who are lonely. It is a great place to go to improve your mental health, to be with your friends. And I think that whenever we talk about public health policy, we can't just talk about the impact of alcohol on our bodies and the cost to, say, the NHS. We have to talk about the way that it is positive on the world that is outside of just, you know, the actual drug of alcohol.
And that is a culture thing, because when I speak to my Spanish friends about this, they go, you know, why are the English always, you know, first in the bar and first on the floor sort of thing, you know, doing as many pints as they can. And whereas sort of Germany, you know, other regions, you see them having, you know, pacing themselves and having tappers in between, and the whole, but the whole culture is different, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, British drinking culture is, it's a really interesting one. And I think we definitely probably have, I'm going to be slayed for this, but I don't think we have a particularly healthy drinking culture, particularly because our beers are pretty weak, right? They're session strength, and that sort of comes from the First World War and the rationing of the Second World War that reduced the ABV. So it means that we're not necessarily great at handling stronger beers, for sure. But I think what we've lost a little bit as our pubs has closed, as our breweries have closed, is we've lost some reverence for the way that it's made and the way that it should be consumed and the way it should be with food and it should be with friends. And, you know, that's just a really, it's a kind of nebulous thing to talk about, but it's definitely been the impact of, you know, capitalist pressure on breweries. You know, they were closing left, right and center. They were consolidating constantly. And that's been a real negative. But drinking in moderation, I think, is one of the most powerful things you can do to help your mental and physical health, so long as it's part of a healthy, balanced diet. And I think we've lost sight of that.
Good save. Very good save, Johnny, there, indeed. I'll get you back on to talk about the, because I'm going to run out of time. I'll get you back on when you get the next book out, okay? So we can take this conversation further. If people want to find you online and toast your health and a salut and whatever else, where can they find you, Johnny?
They can find me on YouTube. We're called the Craft Beer Channel, where we make documentaries about beer. And I'm also all over Instagram with that Craft Beer Channel as well, telling stories.
And what are you going to be imbibing over the weekend? Give our listeners a little hint or a little pointer where what they should be drinking this weekend, beer wise.
Well, I'm currently working on a campaign to get British Carscale recognised by UNESCO as intangible heritage. So I'm spending my life at the moment in beautiful old pubs drinking classic British bitters, Timothy Taylor, London Pride, Harvey's Best, all that kind of stuff, and fully intending to do that this weekend. And it's nice weather, so maybe the first pint in a beer garden.
Well, we'll toast you on that one. You can order the book, listeners, via our own virtual bookstore. Johnny, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.